This is the podcast of the German Historical Institute London, a research centre dedicated to supporting and connecting students and scholars from Britain and Germany. The podcast series presents current research in British, German and European history, as well as colonial and global history. For more information on the German Historical Institute London, future events, the GHIL Library, studentships and more podcast episodes, please visit our website at ghil.ac.uk.
Welcome to the GHIL podcast. I'm your host, Kim Koenig, and in this episode, I'm joined by Senior Fellow and Head of the India Research Program, Indra Singhgupta, to talk to Radhika Sinha about her recent GHIL lecture and her research on criminology and scientific penology in India from 1894 to 1955. Our conversation touches on criminal and labor histories and seeks to answer the question of how the history of colonial India can be written into broader global histories. Radhika Sinha is a visiting professor at Shiv Nada University and is currently at the GHIL as an India Research Program Visiting Fellow. Hello, Radhika. Thank you so much for joining us on the GHIL podcast today. It's been, well, not too long ago, actually. Last month, you gave your GHIL lecture on international penology in colonial India. And today we have the chance to speak a bit more with you about your research. So if we want to jump right in, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about yourself and your research. How did the idea for your project come about?
So I've had a very long career in teaching, beginning with the Women's Undergraduate College in Delhi, Miranda House. I did want to talk about those 17 years there because this was a college founded in 1948 at the cusp of independence. And the interest which the government took in founding a secular campus residential college for women is worth noting, given the current context in which there seems to be too much of an investment in policing women instead of opening up spaces for them. Thereafter, I've had taught at Jawaharlal Nehru University and briefly at Aligarh Muslim University. And after my retirement, I've been keeping up with my research. I began with colonial criminal law for my PhD, so in a way I've come back to take up that story again, but in a much more transnational frame now. And my interaction with German academia has contributed very crucially, really, to the shift, or rather to an understanding of the fact that we have to deal with history in different spatial frames, the local, the regional, and the transnational.
I think that's a fantastic way for us to start the conversation. My name is Indra Singhgupta. I am the head of the India Research Program, this institute, and also a senior fellow in global and colonial history. Radhika, you are here as our first senior visiting fellow of the India Research Program of this institute for this year, for 2024. And you are with us for about 2 months this year. So a very, very warm welcome to you on behalf of the program as well. If I could pick up a little bit on, you know, what you've just said about your work. You've worked extensively on the history of law, on crime, criminal justice and colonial India, especially in relation to the history of labor, the organization of labor and labor regimes, control of labor. I want to ask you a question that I have asked other visiting fellows here at this institute before. How, in your opinion, can we do labor history at a time when the field has shifted so heavily? It's our field, the field of history writing, to a focus on culture and identity. How can historians of law and labor, such as yourself, engage with these fairly recent, perhaps not so new anymore, but fairly recent trends in the historiography of colonialism? And what insights do these fields, say the history of law and labor, social relations and culture and studies, what insights can they bring to each other?
So one definitive moment in the transformation of labor history was a greater appreciation of what exactly is meant by labor and the different ways in which labor is produced and the work which goes into producing labor, the domestic work, the cultural work which goes into producing labor, which then opens the field to a whole range of other activities which have to be taken on board. And in the production of labor, then we understand also processes such as gendering or racializing labor, and also allocating the place of labor in hierarchies of labor, skilled labor, unskilled labor, for the third world labor, which is understood to be at the bottom of the social scale, that is coolie labor. I should say that I was basically a historian of law in a wider sense, not only oriented to labor, but also to other issues related to crime and criminal justice. It was in association with the Association of Labor Historians and in association with initiatives taken, you know, around 2007, 2008 by ZMO in Berlin, which was trying to widen the focus of studies of the two world wars to take in the non-European context, that I began to focus on non-combatant labor in a military context, which then led to a substantial volume, The World in Wars, and thereafter to a five-month fellowship for me at the Lichtenberg College in Göttingen, which gave me the opportunity to actually get a grasp of World War I, both in the European context and in the European context, because we don't have the training, such an intensive training in European history. You need that immersive experience to actually to understand the non-European dimension. You have to understand the European dimension pretty comprehensively too. So that was a good opportunity. It also brought me in touch with German historians working now to give colonial history more of a space in German academia by emphasizing the importance of looking at history in different spatial frames, not doing away with the national frame, but understanding how the national frame is itself put into place in interaction with other local, regional and transnational frames.
I think you've given me the push towards a question that I'd actually prepared before this interview, and I wanted to push you a little bit on it. You've just mentioned that you looked at the history of labor and law regimes and criminal justice regimes in the context of regions and nations and international history, and you have addressed the question of the Great War. So picking up from that, given that you have, in my reading of your work, you have returned time and again to the Great War as, if not a great divide, certainly a moment of great historical significance, and something changes as a result. And that you can see that in a lot of your work. So I was wondering then if you could perhaps give us some specific examples of how in your work, in your research, you engage with global history. And following from that, perhaps a more general question about how we as, you know, historians of colonial India or historians of colonialism or historians of regions can, as it were, write the history of these regions or write the history of the colonial experience of these regions into broader global histories.
So in order to write ourselves into the history of the Great War and to write the history of the Global South into the history of the Great War, we would have to then also transform the concept of what we understand as the Great War. And how do we change the timeline? How do we change the spatial frame in order to have a truly global notion of the Great War? And for some, the potential of a clash starts developing from the late 19th century with an escalation of imperial conflict in which a nation like Germany was involved with Britain and via Britain with India. And this kind of imperialist rivalry could take place at many different levels. It could take place, you know, at the level, for example, of explorations in medicine and science, which were very crucially related also to military issues. I think here of Richard Evans' work on cholera in Hamburg, where, you know, it is the British occupation of Egypt, which is taking place at a time when French and German scientists are trying to kind of discover the cholera vibrio. Interestingly, I mean, I'm going off the track, but I found myself housed in a building which is on Robert Koch Strasse, which is why I started reading up about Robert Koch Strasse to understand the India connection. But anyway, that's besides the point, to go back again to the issue of what would be the timeline. So I think the timeline would in fact be the escalation of imperialist rivalry from the late 19th century. And it would take us into Ottoman history thereafter with the breakup of the Ottoman Empire and the kind of tensions this created for empires which had large Muslim populations within their fold. It would then take us into World War I. When this is a war which is not just between nation states, but it is a war between empires or would-be empires. And the timeline would take us beyond, you know, the calling for an amnesty in 1918. It would take us to the continued violence in the Ottoman Empire, the dividing up now of the Arabian part of the Ottoman Empire between Britain and France. And it would, you know, take us at least into the mid-1920s to find the point of some sort of peace or some sort of stability all around. So the Great War then is a watershed. But to understand it as a watershed, we would have to reevaluate the timeline as well as the spatial frame of World War I. We would have to look eastwards, away from Europe, integrating both the Ottoman Empire, India and Russia in the frame.
You went to Germany, but you also spent time here in Britain now. I was wondering, what's the difference between the source material that you work with in Britain versus Germany? Do you notice something there, and how do you situate that in your research?
So the question you asked about archives is very significant, and this is where I think there are very promising developments in the form of the Modern India and the German Archives project, so that we look at, for example, for me, one of the important sources which I was able to use was the German Missionary Archive, which is, of course, not restricted to Germany, but includes, you know, the Basel Mission. And this, you know, brings in the issue of identity as Catholics in World War I, with the Pope, for example, having to look after laity on both sides of the divide. And one of my most pleasing discoveries of World War I was a series of letters written by two Belgian priests who took a labor corps to France in World War I. It was in the Catholic Herald, in a theological library in India. So the Missionary Archives, for example, is something which brings together both British missionary organizations as well as, you know, American, German organizations. Or more recently, for example, in Britain, I've been looking at the Salvation Army archives. And the Salvation Army, really, it decided to stay neutral for very long, at least in World War I. So you're getting both sides of the picture of the Salvation Army's activities. The Salvation Army is giving you a picture of activity in Germany as well as in Britain, as well as in India, in its archives. In addition, the people I've been interacting with, who've been doing global labor history, on issues such as seamen's labor, etc. I mean, it is one of the most diverse workforces. And the port space is the space for, you know, global interactions of an enormous plurality. And I think we still have to write a history, really, of events like World War I and World War II from a maritime perspective that hasn't been done yet. And I think we'll have to use a variety of different archives to do something like that.
Yes, that's very fascinating. Thank you. So speaking of the future, what is the plan for the next part of your project after the fellowship here?
So I have two projects which I'm carrying on with. So one is the one which I presented here, which is I'm trying to understand what the changes in perceptions about crime and criminality look like from the perspective of South Asia. And here, of course, the shift from, let's say, classical liberal views on crime to positivist views about crime was again a global transformation taking place. The consequences of that in terms of working out what it would mean for sentencing or for the nature of the penal regime or for the intervention of state and society to transform environments which seem to be criminogenic is something which was being discussed internationally. You've had people at the German Historical Institute who have discussed issues like scientific policing or the indeterminate sentence and why it had a greater purchase in some countries rather than others. So I'm drawing upon that literature. I talked about German criminologists like Heindel, who used India as one of the case studies to decide whether Germany would go in for a colony for transportation or not as one of its options. The other project, which I carried out at Münster University, was on the Foreigners Act in India. The project was oriented to understanding legal pluralism. The Foreigners Act sort of came within that framework because the Foreigners Act in India was used not to deal with foreigners as we understand them today, but it was used to manage jurisdiction plurality of the British Indian Empire. It was used to manage the boundaries between territories which were ruled directly by the British, those which were ruled by the princely states, so French and Portuguese enclaves in India, as well as so-called Asiatic states on the borders of India, like Afghanistan and Persia, which were technically independent. But there was a hierarchical notion of sovereignty. So there was this idea that Afghanistan and Persia, somehow their sovereign rights could be encroached upon in a way which would not be possible for European states. So it was in that context that I studied the Foreigners Act in the 19th century, but there were shifts which began to take place by the late 19th century in the use of the Act.
And of course, the first of these two research areas is the one that you talk about in the talk.
Really, really interesting. I hope that our listeners will enjoy this interview and the lecture as much as we did. And we look forward to having you here a little while longer and, of course, to seeing you again.
Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Inba.
Thank you for listening to the German Historical Institute London podcast. Follow us on social media and check our website to keep up to date with new episodes.